Ja, guten Abend, good evening, and welcome to this expert talk in the context of our exhibition Casablanca Art School, the Postcolonial Avant-Garde 1962 to 1987, which we inaugurated yesterday night. We are here in one of the main spaces of the exhibition, surrounded and literally immersed into some of the most impressive paintings by some of the artists of the exhibition. My name is Esther Schlicht. I'm the head of exhibitions here at CERN, and I'm very pleased and honored to welcome and briefly introduce our guests, Murat Montazami and Madeleine de Colnay, the curators of the exhibition, who are the founders of Zaman Books and Curating, which is a platform, a publishing and curatorial platform dedicated to the study of African, Arab, and Asian modernism and postcolonial art history, and who have conceived an impressive number of books and outstanding exhibition projects beside this exhibition on the Casablanca Art School, such as the current exhibition Présence Arabe at Musée d'Art Moderne in Paris. So please go to Paris to see this show. And welcome to Muja Maraini Melehi, who is a film director and the daughter of Mohamed Melehi, one of the main and major artists of the Casablanca Art School group, and of Tony Maraini, the Italian art historian who became the leading intellectual figure of the Casablanca Art School group. Muja Maraini Melehi is also the representative of the Mohamed Melehi estate, and she has just produced a wonderful and impressive film on the work and legacy of her mother, which is on view in our exhibition. So for this talk, we have planned for about 1 hour, and it will be two different parts. The first one relating to the exhibition and questions around the themes of the show, and the second part dealing more specifically with the work and legacy of Mohamed Melehi and Tony Maraini. So to start with the show, maybe a first question to you, Murat. 10 years ago, very few people outside Morocco would have known who or what the Casablanca Art School is. Now we have this exhibition 10 years later here at CERN, which has traveled internationally from Tate St. Ives to Sharjah Art Foundation to Schönkunsthalle Frankfurt. We can also see works by artists from the Casablanca Art School at the current Venice Biennial. And there has just been a residency program initiated by KW Berlin, Think Art Casablanca, IFA Gallery, Sharjah Art Foundation, and Zaman, with artists and researchers and designers revisiting the legacy of the Casablanca Art School. So what has happened in these 10 years?
Thank you very much, Esther. Very happy to be with you. So indeed, it has been 10 years of research. So 10 years of research, indeed, throughout different institutions, different collections. So yeah, it was around 2014, indeed, that we began this research. I think I was also lucky to be kind of at the right time, at the right moment. It was at the Tate Modern in London, where I used to work as a research curator, that we began to research more deeply about the Casablanca Art School artist. But of course, there were also other scholars, researchers, curators in Morocco from the new generation, or, you know, who were anyway born after the era of the Casablanca Art School artist, who had begun to do this research and try to assemble some fragments or parts of that complex history, because we're talking about artists working together since the beginning of the 60s. And it's true that paradoxically, the 20th century and especially post-World War II artistic movements in Africa and the Arab world were very often not well archived or not so much remembered after their own time. So there was definitely something a bit like archaeological in the way you should go in terms of reassembling the puzzle in a way. And of course, the main person you would go to begin with are the artists who were still alive, because Mohamed Melehi and Farid Belkahia were still alive when I began this research in 2014. it was also an objective for the Tate to have eventually the three artists from this trio of Melehi, Belkahia, and Sheba in their collection. And it took some time. But in the meantime, I began to travel to Morocco. It's even in Morocco that I met Madeleine, because Madeleine happened to work in an art center in Rabat called Cult Gallery. And it's even a country where my sister adopted a child in an orphanage in Morocco during the same time. So there were so many things eventually connecting me and us to Morocco anyway. And the artistic scene over there, and also the intellectual scene of curators and critic and like cinema researchers or contemporary art researcher, has been really growing since the 2000s. So of course we did a lot on our own somehow, and there's a lot of time I was alone, and there was also a lot of other times that I would meet with first the family of the artists and the artists themselves, and then different people that gathered almost like a community of researchers and curators and contemporary artists interested in the Casablanca Art School. And I was saying that the complex of assembling this kind of unarchived or undocumented movement at the scale of the 20th century has also had to do with the fact that it's, of course, not preserved by the state itself, the state of Morocco or the Ministry of Culture, which is actually doing great things, but it just happens that they couldn't archive all their own 20th century history. But this is common to a lot of previously third world countries, related to the archive also, because it's a different cultural relationship to the archive, but also because it's a collective history. It's so collective. There were so many artists and so many poets and so many writers and publishers and companions of at different times and different profiles related to the Casablanca Art School network or the Casablanca Art School collective somehow, that you can always find new testimonies and new person to interview. And that's why in the exhibition we have only around 20 or 22 Moroccan artists related to the Casablanca Art School. But in theory, I think we could have even included maybe 35 or 40 Moroccan artists related to this movement or this network of the Casablanca Art School. So these are all the reasons why it's difficult, and it's not so easy to reconstitute that history, also because you need to go through oral history, personal accounts and testimonies, sometimes more official archives related to the places or the buildings in which they exhibited their work, or the architects with which they collaborated. So basically the archival material of all that story was extremely scattered and extremely forgotten. And so it was a matter of collaborating with the artist family, and particularly with Mohamed Melehi's family and with Tony Maraini, who fortunately is still alive and with us living in Rome, who was always incredibly generous for opening her doors to us and especially trusting us. But all of this took some years. All of this took 10 years, basically.
Yeah, it makes obvious that now with this exhibition, where all this material and this research is really presented to a larger public for the first time, we really can speak of a kind of rediscovery of the movement. But maybe also for our guests who didn't have the chance to see the exhibition yet, we can stop just a moment on the main title, Casablanca Art School, that you can maybe explain a little bit what it means. It's not only a movement. I think it means different things that could also be part of an introduction.
Yes, so of course the school existed as a public or official or colonial and national entity. I mean, let's say as a building, but as an art school founded during colonial times, during the time of the French protectorate. You have to know that basically around the end of the 19th century, beginning of 20th century, all the museums which are established and built in Morocco are built by the French and the Spanish, who occupy Morocco and also build a museum, like build a cultural infrastructure inherent to the colonial framework or period or apparel. And it's a matter also of when independence arrived, and the independence of Morocco was 1956, how these infrastructures pre-existing in colonial times will be transformed and reshaped and rethought in post-colonial sequence and time. Therefore, the Casablanca Art School artists use and take somehow colonial heritage of an already existing fine art city school in order to change it, make it something else when they arrive by the beginning of the 60s. And therefore, it also takes, they also take their name of Casablanca Art School, therefore, as a group of individuals who gather in a specific moment. And moreover, to this double-sided history of an already existing colonial school, which will be transformed from the inside by a new community of local artists and professors who create this backlash to the colonial way of working and the colonial fine art ideology based on Greco-Roman sculptures influence, whereas these new artists are going to debunk all of that colonial heritage through more local and vernacular culture of the jewels, the rugs, and different symbology and linguistics to have to do with the Amazigh heritage, which they use as a new kind of aesthetic motor or aesthetic repertoire for their works, will create something more than just a school. So that's where you can consider them a movement, an aesthetic movement, a social movement, and you can also consider them a constellation of artists rather than a group, because they move in number. They can be six of them exhibiting on the Jamaa Eftan Square in 69, then there can be 12 of them gathering as the Moroccan delegation at the Baghdad Biennale, and then there were like 20 or 30 of them when they gathered for the Asila Festival, creating these incredible murals involving the children and the women of Asila, which we can explain more afterwards with Muja, because she has first-person memories and experience of this festival.
Yeah, you have mentioned a number of themes that are also elaborated within the exhibition. And within the exhibition, we are telling the story of the school in 8 different chapters, I guess. Maybe it would be nice to have a brief overview on the different themes, which is also a chronological path through the history of the exhibition. But then we could also mention the main topics.
Sure. So very briefly, you have these different sections in the exhibition, which are not too loaded, let's say, because the artworks themselves can also be overlapping through these sections. So there's the beginning section, to deal when Farid Belkahia and then Mohamed Melehi and Mohamed Sheba and Tony Maraini arrived as the new professors and the new teaching staff of the Casablanca Art School. So that's the introduction room, because they were also experienced in Western capitals and Western art before returning to Morocco and creating that new school of art. And then we dive into this very large room and space of making art public that has to do with their strategy and landmark statement, collective statement of showing art outdoor on public square, but also in high schools, like the girl high school image behind us. And then you have the student exhibition of 1968, which are the works displayed on this other side over there, entitled Creating Collectively, where the students and the professors create together this new aesthetic for a newly independent country and the newness of all of that, up until the ceramics over there, which are included in this discourse about the students and collective creativity. Then we have artists who were in dialogue with the Casablanca Art School without being part of the group, like Ahmed Sherkawi, who is exhibited over there on the left. And then afterwards, in the other rooms, in the next section, you have a graphic design section in which we show all of their posters, leaflets, all their graphic design, even for their own exhibition posters, their magazines and journals, because you understood these artists were not strictly painters or visual artists, but also much more than that, graphic designer, muralist. And then ongoing section with the Afro-Amazigh heritage, on the one hand, showing the craftsmanship behind this Amazigh vernacular culture with jewels, rugs, and painted ceilings. And then you have a section of integrated arts when some architects building newly designed hotels in the outskirts of Marrakech in the desert would commission large-scale works and decorative panels to the Casablanca Art School artists, who also think about a design for every day. And then you have two more sections, one about the Baghdad Biennale of 1974, which is one of the first Afro-Arab third worldist biennial in the 70s, where the Casablanca Art School artists represent Morocco. And then finally, the Asila Festival that we entitled Open Air Museum, Asila being this small city which I mentioned briefly, where they created this festival of mural painting, but also much more. Asila was a platform for theater, for music, for dance. So we only show one side of the Asila Festival, really, in the last room, because the Asila Festival could deserve a whole exhibition in itself. So that's the overall track.
Yeah, of course, we cannot speak about all the 22 artists that we have in the exhibition, but I think it would be nice to learn a little bit more about the three main artists that you already mentioned, Farid Belkaia and Mohamed Melehi and Mohamed Sheba, who all came back to Morocco after independence with different histories, with different experiences in different places in Europe and also in the US, and really coming together there with a vision of really creating something new and bringing forward not only the arts, not only creating something like a modern art, but also building a new society in a way. And I think it would be nice to hear a little bit about their different trajectories, what they brought to Morocco from these different places. Maybe this is a question for Madeleine.
Sorry, I speak badly English, so I will speak French. Oui, on pourrait parler donc de ces trois figures importantes qui sont les piliers de cette exposition, qui sont donc Farid Belkaia, Mohamed Sheba et Mohamed Melehi. Farid Belkaia fait partie de ces artistes qui iront se former en Europe, notamment à Paris, dans un premier temps aux Beaux-Arts de Paris, et puis va partir dans les pays de l'Est, à Prague, où il va retrouver toute une scène artistique marocaine qui est déjà installée, et qui aussi, à ce moment-là, va travailler peut-être une partie de son art la plus engagée, si on peut dire ça comme ça.
We'll try to summarize a little bit. So Madeleine started to speak about Farid Belkaia, one of the main artists who was also the first director in 1962, who was really the one who started to reform the school of Casablanca. And he started to study in Paris and then went to Prague to find out more about the artistic ecosystem there, and also connecting with a whole group of Moroccan artists that were in Prague at that time. And also finding out about how this, in this socialist country, a kind of engaged art was practiced by the artistic scene there.
Oui, dans la première salle de l'exposition, on voit une des œuvres, on va dire, les plus engagées politiquement de Farid Belkaia. C'est cette série qui s'appelle Sévice, et qui évoque justement toute l'horreur qui a pu être menée par l'armée française en Algérie. Et c'est vrai qu'à ce moment-là, Farid Belkaia fait partie est intégré dans un contexte très engagé, communiste, de par sa position à Prague, et donc porte vraiment ce discours très engagé dans sa peinture, qui par la suite va se nourrir davantage des formes et des références africaines en arrivant au Maroc et en se tournant justement sur une histoire peut-être de l'art aussi également préhistorique, puisqu'on peut retrouver dans le sud du Maroc, dans la vallée du Drac, des formes, des reliefs, des gravures qui évoquent totalement les œuvres de Farid Belkaya.
Yeah, so in the introductory room, you can see some of the early figurative paintings of Farid Belkaya, which are these very politically engaged works. He did a whole series called Torches that was dealing with the horrors of the war in Algeria, and that was his most obviously kind of engaged works. But when he came back to Morocco, he started to deal very much with this pre-Islamic Amazigh heritage that Morat has already mentioned, and getting into a more abstract language and moving a little bit away from this directly political engaged works. I can only give a brief summary. The two other artists, Mohamed Sheba and Mohamed Melehi, they had longer stays in Rome and had really a deeper experience in the Italian context. I think this is something that Muja should talk to us about.
They both exhibited their work at my grandmother's gallery, Topazia. So yes, my father arrived in Rome from Spain, actually, because my father was actually born in Azila, which is why, and we will go back, why when he came back to Morocco, his wish was to bring his knowledge and his experience to his hometown. So having grown up in the north, which was really Spanish. He grew up speaking Spanish, you know, because obviously Morocco was divided between the French and the Spanish influence. So the best thing he could do to study art, the closest place he could go to was to study in Sevilla. So from Spain, he goes as a young student to study at the Belle Arti in Rome. And I believe Sheba was there as well, because Sheba was also from the north, from northern Morocco, from Tangier. So they find each other in Rome as young, very young. I mean, we're talking 19, 20 years old, very young men. In the Scuola di Belle Arti, there was this wonderful artist, professor, important in the art world in Italy, Totti Scialoia. And Totti Scialoia was a friend of my grandmother's. I'm just trying to trace the, you know, bring the puzzle together. Was a very good friend of my grandmother's who had a gallery and who was very much open to meeting artists from the international scene. And she used to have, I mean, she had very well-established artists, but she used to have this thing where she would have 20 young artists. So she would welcome and open the doors to 20 young talents. And Totti Scialoia had said, there is this Moroccan artist, this young man in my class that I think you should meet. So that's how my father met my grandmother. And then both Sheba and my father, Mohamed Melehi, exhibited in Galleria Trastevere. Then, as Madeleine was saying, my father also had the opportunity to go to study with a scholarship to the United States, to Minneapolis. So he had that. And, you know, it was his dream, like many, to go to America, to go to New York as an artist, to be an artist in New York City.
That's beginning 60s.
That's the beginning of the 60s. So we're talking late 50s in Rome. In 1959, my grandmother, I think he's the youngest ever artist to have a solo show in Rome. this young Moroccan
from
artist.
From Morocco, definitely.
From Morocco, yeah. Definitely. And 1960, he's in America, as you said. So I'm translating a little bit what Madeleine said, so we can go back to what... he had this experience exhibiting his work in Washington, right?
Yeah.
With the formalists?
Yeah.
And
in,
also,
in which he was exhibited alongside Mondrian, and he was very excited about it.
There you go. Which is not bad, not a bad start. And also with eight Italian...
eight artists from Rome.
From Rome. So there were eight artists from Rome, and there were many nationalities. He was Moroccan, but...
from Rome.
Put together with this... because Rome at the time was very cosmopolitan and very, you know... And so, and after that, as Madeleine mentioned, showed his work at MoMA, also with a group of
1963.
Artists. 1963. So all of that was quite an experience for him. And then going back to Morocco, 1964. But my mother was in the United States at the same time. So they both, I would just like to add that because the duo, if we want to talk about the duo who then goes back to Morocco, she follows him to Morocco. They fall in love, but they also fall in love with the same ideas. And I think that one of the wonderful, inspiring things that happened in the United States at the time was, you know, in the midst of the civil rights movement, activism, I remember my mother always listening to Bob Dylan and John Baez. And, I think that was had a very strong impact on both of them.
Which means that before returning to Morocco to think about a post-independence or a newly independent context,
yes,
even the civil rights movement in the America and the struggles for the civil rights of racial minorities was something extremely vivid. So,
yes.
So there was, let's say, a global decolonizing context.
Absolutely.
From America to Morocco, in a way.
Yes.
Even if the contexts are different, of course, but it's interesting.
Of course.
That they
but this idea of activism, and also, I mean, you know, I mentioned Bob Dylan, it seems, but using art to send a message, art for activism, right? And so as soon as they go back to Morocco, they meet up again with Mohamed Shebbah, who had gone back to Morocco, and Farid Belkahia. And this is how Farid invites both my mother and my father. So instead of saying mother and father, let's say Mohamed Melehi and Tony Maraini. to join the faculty of this school, because Belkahia was named director of the Casablanca school, correct?
In 62, yeah.
Right.
He experimented his director role for 2 years.
For 2 years.
Before he invited Tony and Melehi and Shebbah. First,
Shebbah
Tony
came later.
And Melehi, 64. Then 1 year after, Shebbah. And Bert Flint also
and
came.
Bert Flint. So the idea,
and some of the artists that we see here also became professors, but later on, in the late 60s, like Hafid, Hamidi, etc.
Right. As the old, from what I understand from my mother, as the old professors were leaving the school, they would bring in some of their friends from that group.
Exactly. Because when Belkahia arrived as a director, there were still professors, let's say, from the old era or from the previous era.
Right.
Not meaning that all of them were uninteresting
or
all of
not.
Them were... Some of them actually had already introduced some notions of applied arts or local visual culture before the arrival of Farid Belkahia. But of course, it's when Belkahia arrives, and even more so when Tony and Melehi and the ones we mentioned arrived, that they really changed the way of thinking the school and really changed the... even the curriculum of the school, because they literally invent each workshop, like new workshop and new methodology, of course.
I think
in this context it's interesting because there's always this reference to the Bauhaus School, right, with the Casablanca Art School. But here you really have the impression the professors, they are, and at one time they are professors and teaching and they build up classes, but at the same time they are really shaping their own trajectory, right? Like they were part of this learning process and finding process. I mean, Belkahia was so young when he became the director. That's 29. Right.
They were all in their 20s.
Yes.
And what I just want to add to that is that there was a spirit of cooperation with the students. So it wasn't, you know, we are the faculty and you are you should do what we say. It was, I think, exploration. Malika Gznaj comes to mind. I see her work there. She was one of the students. But, you know, she really was one of the group. And it, I think, I mean, Hariri as well. They were all these young students who worked. They were collaborating. There was a collaboration.
They did it together.
They did it together,
huh?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was no hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think if we look in this room, all these influences that they brought from their Western experience, from the States, of course, especially, but also from other places, you can really see them and find them in the works. I think you can find some relations, but then it would be interesting to maybe explain a little bit more how then it changed when they came back to Morocco, because I think Belkahia, for example, who started to work with very different materials, and for Malehi, it was also, I think, a way of seeing abstract art in a really new way when he came back to Morocco, wasn't it?
It's interesting when you said, well, you know, this young man from Morocco, Spain, Rome, New York, a show with Mondrian. You'll see some of that influence there. I think Rome was a time of great experimentation. I mean, you see in his early work, you see the Arte Povera, you see Burri, you see a lot of those influences. And so, yes, and I think being away from home, you know, it's always when you go away from home, from your home, that you begin to understand where you come from, because you have enough distance, right? And I think coming back to Morocco, at least speaking for my father, of course, Belkahia, we can speak, as Madeleine mentioned, the pre-Islamic art, the work on prehistoric caves, the work on leather and henna, using all
animal
that
skin.
Animal skin and henna, right? My father, of course, a lot of the work they did with Bert Flint, traveling, the symbolism they talk about from the jewelry. The jewelry, the khamsas. So you see the influence, you see the colors. I don't know if I answered the question. But
no, the rug making tradition of the Amazigh or the Berber people. Melehi and Tony and Bert Flint kind of demonstrated the Africanness of that culture, which for a lot of people was only identified to North Africa or the Maghreb. And through their studies, through their collaborations, through their travels, they also demonstrated that the same signs and symbols and technique and craft existed also all around the Saharan countries.
In the sub-Saharan.
And as a matter of fact, sub-Saharan Africa, a trans-Saharan geography of North African countries and Saharan belt countries. Niger, Chad, Mauritania, Burkina Faso, Mali, where the Amazigh culture really exists, and even Amazigh language is used. So this was also about the Africanness of that culture.
The Africanness of that culture, and the nomads, because they were nomadic cultures, and so how those symbols really traveled all the way up to
Absolutely.
Northern Africa. And there is that famous story talking about the Casablanca Art School of them sort of re-evaluating the curriculum and trying to bring up the heritage, you know, the local heritage that was already there to tell the students, you really. All you need to do is look around you. So the story of my father bringing a rug with him to class and hanging it on the wall and saying, "Look, this is Paul Klee." Right?
Yeah. So. Exactly. What about the symbolism of the wave? Because it's the thing that we never really discuss about, because we know that there's almost an infinity of ideas or feelings that can be related to this very minimalistic and very simple pattern of the wave.
Well, it's a primordial. It's such an ancient symbol.
It's very ancient, because Melehi used to say it's one of the basic units of all the, let's say, African, Asian, and Arab classic traditions, in a way, but almost as a unitary fragment that you can find in calligraphy, in mosaics, in...
The curve.
The curves or the architecture. Yeah. And as you said, also this more cosmic relationship, which is the sea, but also the wind, the fire, the flame.
The energy. My father was also, and especially that whole time in New York, right? The IBM.
And there is the computer side of it, which is another layer to the wave symbolism.
Sound. It was about sound. It's about energy. It's he talked about the sensuality of the wave. For him, the wave was feminine. It was the woman quality, right?
But what about this kind of computer or sound? Because I think you thought about it lately.
Pulsations, pulse, the pulse. My father loved music, and I get my love of music through him. Actually, both my children are musicians now, so it traveled far. He was a percussionist. He was an incredible drummer.
Well, he played the percussion.
He was an incredible drummer, and he really, he used to play at his opening.
At his openings,
his shows, yes.
He would play the drums
because the music was part of the work, was part of the creativity. That's why he loved, as you know, he loved jazz. When he was in New York, one of the things he loved to do was to go to, to jazz clubs and hang out with Thelonious Monk and Charlie Mingus and
he saw these guys. He saw these guys in concert in New York.
Not only he saw, he talked to them. And I know that he would go to this club and wait for the after the sets to sit and talk. I know Charles Mingus. They would talk about what it meant to be, the Africanness and very interesting. I wish he were here to...
Regarding that connection between Afro-American jazz and African drums in general, another very interesting connection is with an Afro-American jazzman called Randy Weston.
Randy Weston, actually, yes. And my father would design a lot of his records and a lot of his posters.
Of Randy Weston.
They had quite a relationship, which brings us to the Asila Festival, because during the festival, there was always some jazz. Actually, one year, there was a fusion, and this was before it was, hip and fashionable to have this fusion. He invited the Gnawa musicians, and they played with this jazz musician. His name was Peter Lammer. He was from England, and they just improvised on stage. It was incredible. And there's a record
during the
of
festival.
That. Yes, during the festival, I think it was one of the first years, and so all of this, the music, the art, the activism, all of this really culminates in this project that was designed to bring everything back to his hometown. I mean, it really is. It's the hero's journey,
Yeah.
You know the hero's journey? Joseph Campbell talks about the hero's journey. You go full circle, you come back, you bring the gift.
Do you think you can tell us more about Tony's role, about the Asila Festival itself, about creating this festival? Because now we tend to mention that Mohamed Melehi co-founded that festival with the future mayor of Asila, who is still to this day the mayor of Asila, Mr. Mohamed Ben Aissa. Tony Maraini also had a role in thinking the idea of the festival.
Yes, she's a bit forgotten. And in fact, when you go online and you find it's always co-founded by Mohamed Melehi, Mohamed Ben Aissa, who co-founded it. They co-founded it together. Now, Mohamed Ben Aissa was also... from Asila, was also a dear childhood friend of my father's. They grew up together. and they were like brothers, and they both went to America, and they had very similar ideas about what they wanted to bring back to their hometown. And so I think it was, I mean, it's true. It is co-founded by the two of them. They both had a very, very important role. My mother also had an important role in this trio that is often forgotten. You know, it's forgotten that, but that happens to women, doesn't it, often? Also because they kind of let it be that way. You know, she was very much behind the scenes. But her work was really mostly with the children. And it was about...
workshops for children.
Workshops for children, which she had already done in Casablanca. In the public schools, in the most complicated neighborhoods, most difficult and underprivileged neighborhoods and public schools, because she believed that bringing art therapy and talking to the children and listening to the children and seeing them, having them be seen through their creativity, was a healing process. And that led also to the work in Bershid, yes, which was a mental institution, very old-fashioned, but at the time it was, the mental institutions were old-fashioned in Europe as well, everywhere. And many of the artists from the Casablanca Art School and artists who later collaborated, or during actually, with the Asila Festival, lent a hand and worked with the inmates of this facility, of this mental facility. So she had done work with children and with mentally ill patients. And in Asila, it was it was 360 degrees. It was about involving the community. I think what my father Melehi and Benaisa wanted was to bring something to their community that hadn't been there, to make art accessible, to make art. You know, something that you didn't have to be, a university or educate, or, you know, whatever. It was accessible to everybody. Mm. And people started painting their homes, you know, white, to prepare the canvas for the artists, because they were very proud. And they would sometimes paint with the artists who were painting the murals. So it really... it brought the idea was to involve everybody. So through the art, through cleaning up the town. This was a small fisherman town.
Even the idea of the festival,
restoring the town,
at the beginning was thought as a way to preserve the city.
To preserve the city, yes.
Even because simply each year when they erased all the murals, they cleaned the houses, it becomes super clean.
Yes.
And it was for Benaisa and Melehi and
Absolutely.
Tony, it was an important issue for the people of Asila to raise their consciousness of the heritage they hold,
to be proud of their city.
And I think after a few years of the festival, they managed, I think, to inscribe Asila to the UNESCO Heritage.
The UNESCO Heritage, but also Asila.
The city itself, as a city.
What I wanted to say is there was a full sort of vision for everything, for the inhabitants. You know, for example, I remember my father saying, you know, the tickets should be a token, it should be accessible, because the idea is that the whole town can come. And I remember when the first concerts on the in the piazza, people were sitting on the roofs of their homes. I mean, it was, the whole town was involved. Mm. And about the children's atelier. So my mother would have these workshops for children, and it was word of mouth. There was no nobody said, you know, there's a workshop for children. The children would speak to each other because they would meet at the beach, and then every day there would be more and more and more, and they had to move to the garden of this. In Asila, there's this big palace, which became the place where the artists would have the workshops, where the artists slept. It became a big, you know, and the children's workshops were happening there too. So there was always need of more space because anyone could just knock on the door and come in, right? Some days she would take all the children, all of us, and we would go to the beach and clean the beach. This is your beach. You should be proud of, you know, so... She made us work, but it was part of the project.
Sure.
Asila
is really a social project.
It's a social project, yes.
Up until unveiling the universal heritage value and patrimony of it as a city, and
yes,
and also as a history, because it's a city with an incredible long-term colonial and post-colonial history, cultural history, and the festival is definitely something that made it resonate globally.
Yes, and also it produced young, talented artists.
I think there's recently a publisher, which is Quarto Publishing, a big British global publisher who contacted you because they're doing this book like the Atlas of Public Art in the 20th Century. And they wanted to include like a small section about the Asila Festival as one of the landmark of 20th century public art, but
yes,
with like worldwide examples in that
worldwide
book.
Worldwide examples.
So it's interesting that these things begin to be recorded as such in global art history, of course.
Yes.
I think the MoMA, for example,
yes,
as we know, the MoMA in New York is also currently working on exhibition projects,
yes,
related to African tricontinental festivals. So I think there's a lot of interest around that history of the festivals anyway.
It's a project that worked. Asila is, you know, as I remember it, I was very little, but I do remember it was a small fisherman town and very modest. And it grew with the festival. It is now called Asila Ville des Arts. And a lot of people now don't even know why. And when they come and visit Asila, there's art everywhere. I mean, I was there last week.
Mm-hmm.
And there are children who sit with their own drawings, asking for, you know, selling their drawings on the street, because everybody can do that. But all of that comes from this idea. 1978, yes. And I mean, I remember Ravi Shankar coming to play. And Georges Moustaki came to sing. And the whole idea was to bring the world to Asila, to the people of Asila.
It's interesting that Asila is still, I mean, the festival still exists today.
Yes.
But at the same time, it seems that the whole history of the Casablanca Art School has also been a little bit forgotten in Morocco as well, right? So it's also... being rediscovered quite recently. I think it would be nice if you could also talk a little bit about the legacy now also in Morocco and also for the contemporary Moroccan art scene, because on the one hand it was always present there and at the same time it seems it has also been a little bit forgotten.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we can say that in the course of the beginning of the 21st century, so in the year 2000s, we've been all actors of that rediscovery. And maybe in Morocco, it began through the journals, the magazine like Souffle. First, they began to rediscover that, I would say, at a national scale. Like, for example, the public library in Rabat, they began to make Souffle available online, for example. I think it was 2014. At the same time, we could begin all of that. Souffle was a journal, kind of anti-colonial, but also very poetic, politically engaged, but catalyzing some artists, poets, that you can see in the graphic design section, founded by the Moroccan poet and activist Abdellatif Labi, who is still alive today, who is one of the most renowned Moroccan poets worldwide, with other people like Tahar Ben Jelloun, etc., who were also on his side. And the Casablanca Art School artists, and especially Melehi and Sheba, were also graphic designers and also sometimes editors in terms of content, because it was mainly a literary and poetry journal, but also dealing at times with visual arts. There were a group of visual artists and poets and writers in the Souffle journal. So these kinds of landmark became things that were republished from 2010, I would say. And then, sincerely, there has been a lot, like, in about Moroccan cinema, Moroccan literature, Moroccan visual arts from the 60s and the 70s, the post-colonial time. There's been a lot of things done, really, even beyond what we're doing. Like, there are so many people who worked on that, published yes. PhD about Souffle, doing books about Moroccan cinema of that time. And Mouja also could tell us about the filmmakers that were around with these visual artists. So now, just to make it brief, yes, there is a very strong and big wave of curatorial and research and even academic work around all of these artistic networks from Morocco. Yeah.
I think some of the young artists, newer artists working today, are rediscovering themselves mm-hmm. The legacy of the School of Casablanca. I have to mention that one of our wonderful Moroccan artists, Amina Aghisnay, who does incredibly interesting work. She's the daughter of one of the students, and it's strange to call Malika a student. She was a student of the Casablanca Art School, but she was also one of the players. And I know that Amina is doing a work with her mother, so bringing to the forefront again, you know, the legacy of the school, and many more. I know Ito Barrada, yeah, also worked on a series inspired by the work from the exhibit in 68.
Yeah, and like even the way she unearths and deals with the history of cinema is also very, deals with the same times and periods of time.
Right.
Mais on peut aussi peut-être expliquer quand même un moment d'oubli, parce qu'il y a eu toute cette période des années noires, des années 90. Avec l'emprisonnement de certaines parties des acteurs de Souffle, Mohamed Sheba. Et forcément, je pense que dans l'écriture d'une histoire de l'art, une histoire culturelle, ça a fait qu'il y a eu ce moment un peu d'interruption et de difficulté de se reconstruire et de réécrire ensemble cette histoire, puisque il y a eu aussi un éclatement à un moment donné, des prises de position différentes, et puis la vie qui fait que plus on est sous une dictature, des moments très durs politiquement, forcément l'histoire a du mal à s'écrire plus lisiblement. Donc je pense que c'est aussi pour ça que dans les années 2000, même plutôt 2010, on redécouvre cette histoire, le temps de passer le trauma ou de passer cette période difficile sous Hassan II.
Right. Yeah, we didn't speak so much about the political dimension of all this work and all these gestures and steps. I mean, be it the rediscovery of the Amazigh tradition, which was also a radical step because it had been forgotten during the colonial times, and it was going back to a pre-Islamic time and so on. So, and also bringing the arts on the street, of course, was a political gesture. So I think maybe we didn't speak enough on about the political impact of all these works at the time. Mm-hmm. And what Madeleine is mentioning is that then in the 70s, especially in the 80s and 90s, due to the political situation in Morocco, all these artists, some of them had been imprisoned in the 70s because of their political activism as Marxist and opposition to the regime. And so there was really this time of, yeah, these oppressive years or decades where it really became totally forgotten. And that's also why only with the beginning of the 2000s it was possible to look into this again. Mm.
Just hearing you, I want to take from something you said, bringing art to the streets. I think that was the main the main project, really. It was bringing it out of the closed doors of museums, and so Asilo was an extension of that, of making it available to everyone. So what they were doing was radical, really, because the government of the time, the Ministry of Culture of the time, had other artists in mind for the museums, for the right, for the events, for the what was the big spring.
They had this spring salon,
Salon du printemps,
and these were the exhibitions that were still colonial minded in a way, in which
and they were organized by, and so the answer, this group's answer was, okay, but we're showing it here in the middle of the traffic in Casablanca. We forget how radical that was, how courageous that was, and how it really altered and changed the course of a history.
I think it was a really nice final point. Also, we are in time, and so I would like to thank all of you for this input, for these insights, and Muja for your very personal and lively accounts that gives a totally different possibility to get into all this. And I have learned a lot today, that things that I didn't hear about during all the times of the preparation of the exhibition. Thank you so much. Thank you all for coming, for your interest. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.